Part 5. Head. Chapter 16. Face to face. 9,500 years ago, just outside the place we now know as Jericho, a baby destined for a remarkable afterlife was born. To mark his special status, his head was bound from ear to ear, the tight strap pressing itself into the top of his soft skull. As he grew, the strap was periodically enlarged and lengthened, but its grip still bit into the hardening bone, rendering the very front and back of his head subtly but solidly swollen. He probably knew he was special. Perhaps headbinding during childhood marked him out as such. But as an adult, he suffered the normal ills of an active, aging body, toothache, abscesses, and a broken nose which had healed at an angle. His faintly twisted nose gave him a rugged look, and his heavy brow and wide, high forehead only made his deep-set eyes look smaller. But his face was softened by the plump curve of his cheeks, his wide mouth, and his sensuous lips. He died sometime in his 30s or 40s, and while his corpse was still fresh, a large hole was cut into the back of his skull, the sliver of bone set aside like a found jigsaw piece. But he was buried in the usual way, beneath the floor of a house. His new existence was about to begin. Sometime after his burial, his head was retrieved. What was left of his skin and flesh was carefully stripped away, and his lower jaw was removed. Damp soil was pushed into the hole in the back of his skull and tightly packed into the cranial vault. The filling was left to dry, and then the packing process was repeated, this time with a finer wet mix, the artisan's fingers leaving their mark as the clay was pushed into place, until it eventually plugged the hole. Strengthened and weighted from the inside, the skull was ready for the next stage of its transformation. The puzzle piece of bone removed from the back of the head was fitted into place. A plaster stopper was used to seal the natural gap where the spinal cord had once entered the head. The bottom of the skull was then thickly plastered and shaped into a chin, enabling the skull to sit upright on its own. Further layers of plaster were added to give the skull a rounded face, and facial features were made anew: mouth, nose, cheeks, ears, and eyelids. White shells from a far-off sea were inserted into the eye sockets, and a smoothing tool was used to polish the plaster to an iridescent shine. The skull had become a gleaming face. The Jericho skull was one among several plastered heads to enjoy a rich social life in its community, and one among many more created from the skulls of men, women, and children across the Levant during the Neolithic period. Some were painted on top of the plaster, giving them red skin. Others were equipped with painted eyelashes or headbands or moustaches or tattoos. Some were accessorized with wigs made of organic materials, perhaps dried river weeds or basket weave. And some were replastered and remodeled several times over, suggesting each facial incarnation was transitory, to be made and remade for particular events or ritual activities. Fusing human bone with both local materials and shells and mineral pigments from distant places, a new being was created. Crafted, displayed, handled, and cared for by the living, these plastered skulls were not simply the deceased restored to life, but the heads of the dead transformed into a different category of person altogether. These new faces had a social power and status unlike the faces of the living, and distinct from the skeletal faces of the ordinary dead buried beneath their homes. They were the faces of those who knew a world beyond the everyday. The living gazed upon the white-eyed faces of these extraordinary beings as the heads sat up and looked back at them, something surviving examples still do today in museum displays. Plaster skulls were not simply objects, but otherworldly social performers. While we cannot be sure why certain individuals were selected for this remarkable afterlife, these artifacts reflect a very human tendency to give a face to imagined realities. From shapes in the clouds to the headlights and bumper of a car, even the vaguest suggestion of two eyes set above a mouth or a nose can become a face. For some, This might speak to an all-too-human self-centeredness, so that we inevitably see ourselves reflected back at us as we walk in the world. But our tendency to find faces in non-human places more plausibly attests to our inherent sociality as a species, so that we're seeking and seeing not ourselves, but other people. As one visual theorist puts it, our perception is most highly attuned to that which is most important and stimulating to us, other human bodies. We naturally find human faces especially stimulating, for they're so very crucial to our social relationships. Framed by our ears, the face is the site of our most informative, communicative senses: vision, hearing, smelling, tasting, and speaking. It's a fleshy site of fixed features, and yet the face is the most malleable and expressive of our body parts. Eyes dart, water, and weep. Eyelids blink, flutter, open wide, and close tight shut. Eyebrows rise, drop, curve, and knit. Noses wrinkle or drip. Nostrils flare, shrink, and blow, and our noisy, moving mouths stretch, purse, pout, narrow, and gape, offering flashes of teeth, gums, and a thick, flitting tongue. When we're face to face, it's an intensely social experience, whether or not a word is exchanged or a touch is felt. Even seemingly still, expressionless faces are socially active by virtue of their very presence. A face-to-face encounter is never a passive experience. Faces are simply too stimulating. God-gazing. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, it's the intensity of a face-to-face encounter with God that worshippers most desire. "When shall I come and behold the face of God?" one plaintively asks in the book of Psalms. "I shall behold your face, I shall take my fill wide awake of your image," promises another. It's easy to dismiss the longing to see God's face as mere fantasy. But this was no hyperbolic fancy of an enraptured imagination. Worshippers hoped for the privilege of pilgrimage to a temple, where they might be lucky enough, or important enough, to see a statue of the deity in all its glory. In a world in which divine statues were manifestations of the gods, to look upon a divine image in a temple was to come face to face with a god. It was to lock eyes with the deity, to see and be seen in the most profound and physical of ways. The artisans of ancient Southwest Asia have left us some tantalizing glimpses of what it might have been like to come face to face with a deity in the temple. During the early dynastic period of Sumerian culture, circa 2900 to 2334 BCE, wealthy worshippers commissioned representations of themselves to stand in the presence of their gods in temples. Carved from alabaster or limestone, these votive statuettes of worshippers stand unsupported, their feet together and their hands demurely clasped at their waists. Their mouths are closed in pious silence, but their enlarged eyes are open wide, their pupils like saucers, their eyebrows raised. They were entranced by the deity before whom they stood. Just as their gods were manifest in their temple statues, so too were these Sumerian worshippers. Face to face with the divine, they stood in a state of permanent, awed adoration, gazing at the gods before them. The emotional intensity of a face-to-face encounter with a divine statue continued to be experienced by generations of worshippers across Southwest Asia. Over 1,000 years after Sumerian statuettes had gazed at their gods, kings across Mesopotamia were continuing to be bowled over by the religious experience of beholding a cult statue. It's an experience recounted on a stone tablet produced during the reign of King Nabu-Apla-Edina of Babylon, who reigned 887 to 855 BCE. It describes the king's restoration of the cult statue of the sun god Shamash, which had been looted from the deity's main sanctuary in Sippar some 2 centuries earlier during an attack by the Sutians from the Syrian desert. In the absence of the cult statue, the god's symbol, a blazing sun disk, had instead received offerings while worshippers waited for Shamash to grant permission to refashion his image. Permission came in the form of a miraculous discovery. A canny high priest called Nabunadin-Shumi fortuitously found a baked clay model of the original statue, from which a new lapis and gold-plated version could be crafted. The result was staggering, as the sublime illustration carved into the top of the tablet suggests. It shows the giant new statue of Shamash enthroned within his ornate canopied shrine in his temple. The over-exaggerated scale of the cult statue celebrates Shamash's divinity, but also points to the overwhelming experience of finally coming face to face with the god. The new statue dwarfs the high priest, the king, and even the goddess who accompanies them into the god's throne room, adopting a diminutive pose in the overwhelming presence of Shamash. Only the two divine attendants, positioned beyond the god's line of sight as they helpfully reposition his solar disk, look vaguely comfortable. The inscription emphasizes that upon seeing the god's image, the king's face was transformed by euphoria, so that he beamed with delight at the high priest. His heart rejoiced, and shining was his face. With his bright face, his ruddy countenance, and his beautiful eyes, happily he looked at him. In the biblical story of Moses, the physiological transformation triggered by a visual encounter with a deity is far more extreme, as we've already seen. Of all the Bible's characters, it's Moses who is repeatedly said to have enjoyed a face-to-face relationship with the deity. Yahweh would speak to Moses face-to-face as one speaks to a friend. It's a point about which the deity himself is unequivocal, highlighting the physical intimacy of their conversations. With him I speak mouth to mouth, an appearance, not in riddles, and he gazes at the form of Yahweh. Moses does not simply see Yahweh, but looks at him. He talks to him, he listens to him, and engages with him. And having spent 40 days and nights with Yahweh on Sinai, it's the corporeal, visual intensity of this social bond with the deity which is understood to transfigure Moses' face in the book of Exodus. Other Yahweh worshippers also felt the visceral, transformative power of seeing their God. In a psalm, one describes the encounter as the stark difference between famine and feast. "My throat thirsts for you, my flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there's no water," he exclaims. "So I looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your strength and glory. My throat is sated with fat and fatness." The deity, too, was likely sated by this meeting, for worshippers were not to turn up to temples without gifts of food. "Three times a year all your males shall see the face of Yahweh your God at the cult place that he shall choose," Moses commands the Israelites. "They shall not see the face of Yahweh empty-handed. All shall give as they are able." Looking upon the face of God was the very purpose of a temple, as Yahweh makes clear in the ancient Greek translation of the book of Exodus. "You shall make me a sanctuary, and I shall be seen among you." Written into the Torah, the command to see Yahweh's face was a formalized reflection of the deity's long-held desire to be seen. "Seek my face," he called to his worshippers. "Come before his countenance," his ritual singers urged. In one psalm, worshippers who ascend the hill of Yahweh and stand in his sacred standing place will receive blessings as they behold the deity's face. And yet God's calls for face-to-face encounters with his worshippers often surprise modern readers of the Bible. As so often, the theological preferences of ancient and modern translators are partly to blame. Translators who tend to soften the firm instruction to seek his face into the more mealy-mouthed, seek his presence. But these translators have also been heavily influenced by certain biblical claims that seeing the radiant face of a divine being might be deadly dangerous or impossible. According to the book of Deuteronomy, the Israelites heard God's voice, but were unable to see his body. In the Gospel of John, the narrator insists that no one has ever seen God, while the writer of 1 Timothy claims that God dwells in unapproachable light and no one has ever seen him or can see him. And yet, several characters in the Bible, including Moses himself, do indeed see God's face and live to tell the tale. These biblical inconsistencies likely derive from competing religious traditions about the extent to which Yahweh might render himself visible to mortals beyond the bounds of his temples. Across the ancient world, deities were understood to be innately dangerous, particularly when they were on the move. Whether betwixt and between temples, or the heavens and the earth, or the city and the wilderness, divine behaviour was far more unpredictable in liminal space. But even when worshippers entered temples, face-to-face encounters with the gods were carefully choreographed. In the regulated environment of sacred space, those people fortunate or powerful enough to be granted an audience with a deity were safeguarded from the potential dangers of the divine gaze by the rituals and furnishings structuring the meeting. Mortal bodies were carefully cleansed, dressed, and accessorized. Sacred unguents, ceremonial clothing, and offerings cloaked them with the aura of holiness, transfiguring earthly bodies into bodies fit for sacred space. Iconographic images of worshippers before the cult statues of their gods suggest that altars, offering tables, lampstands, and the scented clouds of incense burners served as security barriers separating mortals and gods, controlling their encounters. A beautifully detailed example is found on an Assyrian seal from the Phoenician city of Tyre. A woman in a fringed ceremonial robe stands before the imposing statue of a storm god on his pedestal. Her clean, bare arms are raised towards the deity, and between them is an incense burner throwing up smoke and flames, and an offering table laden with rich fabrics and libations. Ritual safeguarding in Yahweh's temples was no different. In the Hebrew Bible, priestly directives about temple practice suggest that clouds of fragrant incense not only called the god to his meals, but served as a smokescreen, blurring direct visual contact with the deity. These smokescreens were easily associated with the thick clouds thought to be wrapped about the god as he thundered through the heavens. Although southern Levantine temples usually had windows through which daylight could pass, some biblical writers insist Yahweh of Jerusalem preferred to dwell in deep darkness. The darkness of the temple's inner rooms, tempered only by lamplight, was likely thought to function as a palpably protective layer, cushioning the impact of the encounter between the deity and his priests. Deep-dyed blue and purple fabrics hanging around Yahweh's shrine in the temple's Holy of Holies similarly enveloped the deity with a degree of privacy, akin to that he was believed to have enjoyed in the old days, camping out in the wilderness with the Israelite tribes. At the same time, the temple curtains shielded worshippers from the overwhelming sight of God, an idea later repurposed by some early Christians who sensationally claimed the curtains had been ripped asunder by the world-changing death of the new, more accessible face of divinity, Jesus himself. Not even Yahweh's most important attendants were entirely safe from the potential hazards of a direct audience with their God. In Jerusalem, the high priest was to be transfigured by holy oil, don sacred vestments, and wear protective amulets and tinkling bells on his body to shield him from the deity as he entered the Holy of Holies. But an unexpected encounter with a deity, away from the safety of a temple, was inevitably fraught with danger, as both Jacob and Moses are said to have discovered. In Genesis, Jacob spends a night wrestling a supernaturally powerful man who later reveals himself to be a god, while in Exodus, Yahweh tries to kill Moses when they suddenly meet in the dead of night on the road from Midian to Egypt. In these circumstances, emergency measures are required. Moses is rescued by the rituals performed by his quick-thinking wife, Zipporah, who anoints him with the protective, sacred blood of a hastily circumcised penis. Jacob's life is saved by his sensible decision to let go of his assailant before daybreak and humble himself before the newly revealed deity, vowing to transform their makeshift wrestling ring into a cult place devoted to him. He names it Peniel, meaning face of God, for, as Jacob says, I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Both stories suggest that Jacob and Moses had unwittingly strayed into the path of a dangerous deity of the night subsequently glossed by biblical writers as Yahweh himself. Their trespassing had triggered a ferocious attack, which was a perfectly understandable reaction. The gods were easily irritated or unsettled by the impropriety of an uninvited visitor or an unexpected encounter. The God of the Bible particularly disapproved of mass gawping. Stories about his early encounters with the Israelite tribes are keen to emphasize the protocols protecting the deity from crowds, busybodies, and rubberneckers. Setting a boundary at the foot of his holy mountain in the Sinai wilderness, he explains to Moses that the Israelites are not to rush up the mountain to see him until they've been invited by the sound of a heavenly horn. As his desert temple is being packed away in readiness for its onward journey to the Promised Land, Yahweh warns that those priests without appropriate security clearance are not to sneak a peek inside the Holy of Holies in its state of undress, not even for a moment, because they will die. Even Yahweh's furniture, his throne, his footstool, his incense burners, his curtains, is imbued with a divinity that's not to be looked upon in its transitory state. It's a basic principle of religious etiquette forgotten or ignored by 70 citizens of Beit Shemesh in 1 Samuel. Their enthusiasm at seeing Yahweh's footstool spills over into voyeurism when they attempt to look inside the ark and are promptly struck dead. Gawping at Yahweh might have prompted divine offence, but stories like these also served very human purposes, both profound and pragmatic. Theologically, staring at a deity was to be discouraged to prevent the reductive objectification of the god. No matter how noble the longing to behold a cult statue or sacred object, the divine was not to be regarded as a mere spectacle for the curious mortal gaze. As a deity, Yahweh was a category of being wholly unlike any other and was to be treated neither as an oddity nor a luxury commodity for those lucky enough to enjoy privileged access to him. But the ancients were just as capable of cognitive dissonance as we are. Stories warning against ogling Yahweh also shored up the powerful positions enjoyed by his priests and temple personnel, with whom the authority to offer access to the deity lay, and whose theologies came to dominate much of the Bible. Like many powerful forms of visual culture today, be it religious relics, films, or pornography, permission to see or not to see is often in the gift of those socially sanctioned to curate, mediate, regulate, or propagate images. And the priests of ancient gods were no different. They not only controlled access to the temples in which the gods resided, but handled larger public relations events when a deity statue might process about the outer courtyards of their house or parade about the streets of their city. Although these more public viewings of the deity were crucial events in the religious calendar, the optics were still carefully stage-managed. A lively example comes from the small but venerable city of Imar in northwestern Syria, where from at least the 14th to the 12th centuries BCE, the city's patron, the fertile god Dagan, ceremonially showed himself to his people in an annual renewal of his devotion to the city. Accompanied by a stream of worshippers, Dagan left his urban temple to visit the ancient standing stones beyond the city walls. There, he and his citizens feasted on hundreds of sacrificial animals before the god mounted his wagon and returned to the city to take up residence once again in his temple. Although the people accompanied Dagan's wagon while he was out and about, their access to him was still restricted, for the cult statue's face was veiled for much of the festival, guarding his privacy and cranking up the crowd's anticipation. It was only at key junctures in the proceedings that Dagan's priests revealed his face. The first occasion was as he passed among the stones, enabling him to socialise with the divine powers there, while the second was when he sat down to feast, allowing the assembled citizens to enjoy a glimpse of their patron deity. Finally, Dagan's face was unveiled again for his joyous homecoming, so that as he travelled, the fields surrounding the city were drawn into his beneficent, life-giving gaze. The power of the veil to shield or distance a deity's face from their worshippers was not only a device employed among large crowds. It also served to shut out the individual petitioner from socializing with their God in their prayers, sometimes in the most devastating way. This is distressingly portrayed in an Assyrian elegy discovered in the remains of Ashurbanipal's library in Nineveh. Its subject is a young woman dying in childbirth, who cries out in fear to the great Mesopotamian mother goddess, by now commonly known as Belet-Ili, Lady of the Gods. Although the tablet on which this poem was inscribed is damaged, rendering some of its lines unreadable, the pain of its poetry is all too easily felt. During the days I was with child, how happy I was and happy was my husband. The day my pains began, a shadow fell across my face. The day my labour started, brightness faded from my eyes. I besought Belet-Ili, fists unclenched. O mother, you that bore me, spare my life. Belet-Ili heard, then veiled her face. Who are you, and why beseech me so? Then to our bedroom stealthy death did creep. From my house he drove me forth, from my husband cut me off. My footfall here he planted, in a place of no return. The intimate visual bond between the young woman and her goddess is distressingly reflected in their faces, even as their relationship breaks down. As the darkness of death dulls her vision and obscures her face, the woman reaches out with open, pleading, praying hands. But the goddess has covered her own face so that it too is darkened. With unseeing eyes, she will no longer recognize her worshipper. Deity and devotee become faceless to one another, and in their facelessness, they are estranged. Hide and seek. The God of the Bible was similarly accustomed to obscuring his face in an effort to sever relationships with his own worshippers. In language conjuring an image of the deity covering his face with his hands, Yahweh is said to hide his face from those he once cared for and now rejects. When you give to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you conceal your face, they are dismayed. Dismayed and cursed. In obscuring his own face, Yahweh exposes unworthy worshippers to the predations of malevolent beings. I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be devoured. Many evil troubles will find them. But hiding his face also renders Yahweh remote. He cannot, will not, acknowledge their distress. They will cry to Yahweh, but he will not answer them. He will hide his face from them at that time, for they have acted wickedly. Like Belet-Ili veiling her face from a dying woman, Yahweh envelops himself in a heavenly garment, dulling his senses. You have wrapped yourself with a cloud so that no prayer can pass through, sobs personified Jerusalem as she laments her destruction at the hands of the Babylonians. The fault, of course, lies with Yahweh's wayward worshippers, whose sins had coagulated about their God's head like a miasma, shrouding his face and muffling his ears. Your sins have become barriers between you and your God, cries a prophet among the exiles in Babylon. Your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear. God's face covering not only rendered him ritually inaccessible, but theologically unapproachable, worryingly remote, and virtually imperceptible to the worshipper. Should a deity hide their face, appeals to an appropriately powerful intercessor were essential. And across the Levant, there was none more appropriate than a senior goddess. In Phoenician cities and their colonies around the Mediterranean, the powerful goddess Tanit was often known as the face of Baal, signalling her role as a mediator between the local high god and his worshippers. But one of the most successful intercessors in the heavenly realm was the mother of the gods herself, who was well placed to intervene on behalf of others, whether mortal or divine. In Ugarit, this role fell to Atherat, wife and consort of Ael, and mother to their 70 divine children. Naturally, it's to Atherat that Baal turns when he seeks Ael's permission to build himself a palace. It's a reasonable request, given that all the other gods have their own palaces, as he repeatedly complains. And yet, As much as Baal has groaned and cried to Ael, permission has not been forthcoming. At first, Baal's sister Anat intervenes on his behalf, but the excessive aggression of her demand does little to help Baal's cause, an unsurprising result given that anyone threatening to smash in their father's head and cleave his skull in two would likely receive similarly short shrift. It's then that Baal and Anat appeal to Atherat to put the case to her husband, bringing her fine furniture as ritual gifts to win her favour. Atherat's approach is more tactful, her manner more gracious, and her influence over her all-powerful husband far greater. Thanks to Atherat, Baal not only got his palace, but Ugarit's citizens had their ideal divine intercessor. It was a role reflected in the golden amulets worn by the wealthy as pendants around their necks, hoping she would champion their causes before the other gods. In stark contrast to the darkened, hidden faces of those gods who chose not to respond to their worshippers, these amulets emphasized the goddess's friendly face, her gentle features, her eyes and ears open wide to prayers and petitions, her golden face radiating blessings. Worn next to the skin, the reassuring warmth of the goddess's beaming face could be felt. Atherat's role as power broker extended to Israel and Judah, where she was known, of course, as Asherah. As the wife of Yahweh, she was instrumental in securing her husband's blessings for his worshippers. It's a skill suggested by that remarkable inscription from an 8th century BCE tomb in Kirbet El Kom in the modern West Bank, in which Yahweh's protection of the tomb's occupant is mediated by Asherah. But whether in life or death, appeals to another deity to intercede were not always successful, at least not as far as some biblical writers were concerned. In the wake of the Babylonian invasion of Judah in the 6th century BCE, desperate exiles and refugees had made offerings beseeching the help of a goddess anonymized in the Hebrew Bible as the Queen of Heaven, a title later recycled for the Virgin Mary, whom worshippers had long credited with helping to ensure state security, economic prosperity, and agricultural plenty. And yet Yahweh was only enraged by their appeals. When the harried protagonist of the book of Job found his desperate cries to Yahweh had gone unanswered, his woefully unsupportive and slightly stupid friend Eliphaz counseled against appeals to any divine intercessor. "Call now, is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn?" he asks. "If it was me," he remarks, with all the condescension of someone who has failed to grasp the point, "I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause." Some worshippers might have found divine intercessors to be too unpredictable or unhelpful, but as he became increasingly reclusive, Yahweh would come to rely on them. By the 4th century BCE, divine messengers were taking on a more distinctively ambassadorial role, for their task was to interface with mortals on Yahweh's behalf, quite literally. One is called his face messenger, and another Yahweh simply names my face. Meanwhile, Yahweh's breath-born daughter, Lady Wisdom, was pitching herself as the most successful heavenly intercessor. "Whoever finds me finds life and obtains favour from Yahweh," Wisdom proudly boasts in the Book of Proverbs. At the same time, parents were advising their children to wear wisdom on their throats like a necklace, an allusion to amulets bearing a goddess's image, akin to those golden pendants once worn by Ugarit citizens, emphasising the deity's welcoming, radiant face and her prominent listening ears, ready to respond to worshippers' petitions. An old proverb embedded in Ecclesiastes, known in Jewish tradition as Koheleth, suggests the radiant blessings conveyed by Lady Wisdom's face could be as viscerally transformative as those of her divine father. "Wisdom makes one's face shine, and the harshness of his face is changed." This biblical aphorism might well read today as a saccharine platitude, reassuring worshippers of the faintly fluffy idea that religious understanding makes people happy. But the cultural backdrop to this little proverb is rather more precise. It recalls the iconography of the gods' faces. Bright blessings shone upon those fortunate enough to behold divine images, bathing worshippers in a warm glow akin to the touch of the sun. This was the shining face of divine favour Yahweh's worshippers had always longed to see, as an ancient prayer in the Book of Numbers so beautifully illustrates. May Yahweh bless you and guard you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his face upon you and give you peace. It was virtually the same ritual refrain as that inscribed on the rolled-up silver amulets from Ketef Hinnom, and the same liturgical incantation as was sung in the Jerusalem temple, which would continue to be uttered in prayers long after the temple's final destruction in 70 CE. When they beseeched their God to make his face shine upon them, worshippers were not simply hoping for a beatific vision, but longing for the highly social, intimate encounter manifest in a face-to-face relationship with their God, much as they or their ancestors might have experienced in his temples. There, the light of oil lamps had danced on the polished glow of the statue's golden countenance, enlivening it with wondrous movement. Bedazzled by the divine, awestruck worshippers had beheld their God's responsive, shining face. And what a face it was.